Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, what happens when the numbers are wrong? We'll spend this hour with math teacher turned stand-up mathematician Matt Parker, who's been collecting real-life examples of notorious miscalculations that resulted in bridge collapses, digital meltdowns, and financial crashes to illustrate how critical numerical accuracy is to a safe, productive existence in the modern world. If you or someone you care about has ever once questioned why we all need to learn math, this conversation will give you the answer. Our conversation starts after a short break. In 1831, 74 perfectly synchronized soldiers went marching across a suspension bridge near Manchester, England, and experienced something truly bizarre. As they crossed in rows of four men, the span itself started bouncing right along with them in perfect rhythm. That extra spring made it easy to march. It felt so good, the bouncing soldiers started whistling a tune together. But then the music stopped abruptly because the structure collapsed, and they all went plunging into the river below. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We refer to this sort of event as an accident most of the time, but this one could more precisely be defined as a miscalculation. Suspension bridges are susceptible to resonant frequencies that can cause them to move catastrophically in response to synchronized movement on them. The problem can be predicted and prevented using math, but they didn't know that yet in 1831. Matt Parker used to teach math to students, and he spent years making the case for its importance in everyday life. These days, he writes about math for The Guardian. He does stand-up mathematics as a comedian and YouTuber, and he hosts the Science Channel show Outrageous Acts of Science. His new book is called Humble Pie: When Math Goes Wrong in the Real World. He joins us from the BBC in London to talk about it. Matt, welcome to Think.
Oh, Chris, thank you very much. It's an absolute honor to be here.
Help me understand what exactly went wrong when that bridge collapsed. It wasn't the weight of a few dozen soldiers.
No, there were only 60 soldiers crossing that bridge. And actually, if you had challenged them to break the bridge, they would have struggled. Like, it's not an easy thing to break, you know, a massive kind of bolted together, riveted kind of classic, you know, Victorian era engineering bridge just with the force of 60 humans. And you're right to call it a miscalculation. In this case, though, we can forgive the people who did the original calculations when they were designing the bridge, because this was a whole new way for bridges to move and break. And now it's kind of the classic example of when people walking on a bridge matched, as you said, the resonant frequency.
What happened to the Tacoma Narrows Bridge in 1940?
Yeah, well, that's a very similar situation. So a lot of people may have seen this famous footage of the bridge in Tacoma in Washington State, where, and amazingly, when it collapsed, there was a photography shop nearby, and they were able to run down with one of these kind of newfangled portable film cameras. And this was in the early 20th century, to film this. It should have been a rigid road bridge, except it was suddenly twisting and distorting and going all over the place. And it was a very similar situation where the bridge in 1831, the troops, as they were marching, hit a frequency where the bridge was accidentally tuned to vibrate at that frequency. And so some people may be familiar, if you're at a concert and you're holding a glass, some music notes, you'll feel the glass almost vibrating. Or if you've got a guitar and someone plays a note nearby, one of the strings will almost like sympathetically start vibrating at the same frequency. It's because in a guitar, we've tuned the string to vibrate incredibly easily at one very specific frequency, or rather a range of specific frequencies. And in this case, it was accidental. They accidentally built the bridge in, this was just outside Manchester in England, to vibrate at the frequency the troops were walking. And for the case of Tacoma, what had happened was the wind coming down kind of the valley where the bridge was built was able to catch the bridge. And this was part of how it was designed. The wind caught it and initially would raise up kind of the leading edge that's closest to the direction the wind's coming from. And then once the bridge can lift up no more, it would snap back. And now the wind would push it down, and then it would snap back and push it up. And you get what's called flutter, where it's reinforcing this one frequency by pushing it up and down. And they accidentally built a bridge where the middle of it had enough ability to twist and rotate that once this flutter kicked in, it was a feedback loop. It got worse and got worse, and eventually the bridge collapsed.
Yeah, I highly recommend people Google it because it really is fascinating.
It's incredible footage.
Yeah. Some people listening might be old enough to recall the Kansas Hyatt disaster in 1981. This was like a tiny modification made to the original design of an elevated walkway. What went wrong?
Yeah, and this is similar to the bridges in that if we're using math to design things in engineering, we're using math kind of to supplement our intuition. Like a modern building, you couldn't look at it and just eyeball it and go, yeah, that's definitely going to stand up. And so we use math as we best understand it to describe the world around us. In the case of these bridges, there were situations that came up where we hadn't accounted for them in the mathematics. For the case of the Kansas City Hyatt Hotel, what had happened was the engineering had been done correctly in the first place, and all the calculations had been done to suspend these pedestrian walkways in the lobby. And these are a fair way up off the ground. And they had one about where the first floor was and one about where the third floor was, so people could walk right across this atrium. And if you're designing something like that, you don't want to guess. You don't want to leave it to chance. You want to do the calculations, check and double check. And that had been done. But then when they were building it, they made a change to the design without redoing the math. Hmm. And they just kind of thought, you know what, we'll make this one change. And what it was originally there was going to be a single rod that was attached to the ceiling, and then this rod would descend all the way down. It would go through the top walkway that would then be bolted onto the rod, and then all the way down through the lower walkway that's then bolted onto the rod. And there'd be many, many of these rods all coming down, going through both walkways. However, when they were building it, they're like, oh my goodness, it's such a pain to get these bolts all the way out. Like, it's really, like, if you've ever had to wind a bolt along a, like, run a nut along a long bolt, you're already thinking, oh, this is tedious. Imagine doing it, like, across stories. And so they were like, you know what, it'd be way easier to build if there was one bolt that came from the ceiling down to the top walkway and then ended, and then a second bolt is then attached to the top one, and then that descends down to the bottom one. And that's, like, way easier to put together. And the calculations were not redone. And what they missed was previously, each walkway, there were nuts on the descending rod which would hold the weight of the walkway above them. And each of these nuts was rated to hold the mass, or, you know, the force coming from each walkway. When they changed the design, it meant that all the mass from the lower walkway was directly attached to the top walkway, and then that was separately attached to the rods through just the one bolt. I say it's a bit like if you imagine you've got two mountain climbers abseiling. If they're both holding onto the same rope, they've only got to support their own mass. If you changed it so the lower climber was attached to the top climber, They're now holding on frantically because they've got to not only hold up their mass but the other climber who's attached to them. And that was the change that they made in the design. And sadly, eventually there were enough people on the walkway simultaneously that the bolts gave way. So the nuts that were underneath, because the ones at the top were now holding up the mass of all the people on both walkways, they ruptured, and sadly over 100 people died in the collapse. And so those of you who may remember this from July in 1981, it was an absolute tragedy. And I had to be careful because I was writing a book called Humble Pie, and I wanted it to be an entertaining, engaging read. But I couldn't get away from the fact that if you make a math mistake in engineering or aviation or medicine, people's lives are at risk. And so I included this story as a kind of, you know, sober reminder that if you don't double check the math in some of these life and death situations, people can die from a simple overlooked miscalculation.
So this show is produced in Texas, and recently the talk of the city where I live has been something called the Leaning Tower of Dallas. I can't imagine you've heard anything about this.
No.
This building was set to be demolished with explosives. Somehow the people who planted the explosives did not calculate what it would take to knock down the kind of center core that was the elevator shaft. So the outside of the building came down as expected. The center core started to come down and then stopped and is now leaning. And engineers and demolition crews are having to figure out what to do about that.
Oh, that's fantastic. Because modern buildings are pretty much kind of just hung off the central elevator shaft. So, whoops. I mean, yeah, someone miscalculated somewhere. And it's a messy thing to try and simulate and calculate when you're trying to use our current human understanding of math to predict what will happen when you're doing something like this. And I guess there aren't that many examples to go off. It's not a particularly common thing, I imagine. So I am going to look that up in the next break and see if I can find a photo.
One thing that math does for us is to help us process numbers that really are too big for the human brain to kind of get a handle on. For example, you point out that the difference between a million and a billion is, of course, a tiny fraction of the difference between a billion and a trillion. But unless we know how to use math, we don't necessarily conceive of it that way.
Yeah, and this is what I like going on about how, as a human, we're not naturally good at mathematics. So we're born with a little bit of understanding of number and a little bit of understanding of geometry, but it's not particularly good. And one thing that continues to trip us up is big numbers. Small numbers, because we're all forced to go to school and everyone, like it or not, is normally forced to learn math at school, we get kind of okay with smaller numbers just through sheer exposure. Big ones still trip us up, and comparing millions to billions to trillions is an absolute classic. So what I do is get people to try and guess how long from now 1 million seconds will be. And spoiler, I'll give away the answer. From right now, 1 million seconds will happen on the 7th of March this year, 2020. And so it's just over 11 days away. And that's kind of, that's like human scales that we're fine with that. We can all imagine, you know, it's less than 2 weeks from now, a million seconds. So, okay, if a million seconds is the 7th of March, when is 1 billion seconds from now? And a billion seconds from right now is the 2nd of November in the year 2051.
Wow.
And that's a huge jump from under 2 weeks to 2051. And a trillion seconds from right now will be in the year 33,708. So just the ridiculously distant future. Fun fact, it'll be the 20th of November, which will be a Wednesday. There you go. So that's what people want to double check that. So 1 trillion seconds is 33,000 years old. It's insane when you think about these things. And it's because our brains, we kind of expect the increase from a million to a billion to be about the same as the increase from a billion to a trillion. But that's not the case. That's 1,000 times bigger. And because our brains kind of view all millions, billions, trillions as being big numbers, we forget how incredibly different they are. And I mean, the example I like to give is people say, well, what's the difference between a billion and a trillion? Well, it's about a trillion, because when you're looking at a trillion, a billion no longer matters.
Yeah, because it's one out of 1,000 parts, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's 0.1% of a trillion. So if as soon as you're talking billions, millions no longer matter. If you're talking trillions, billions no longer matter.
My guest is Matt Parker, a stand-up comedian and YouTuber and former math teacher who writes about math for The Guardian and hosts Outrageous Acts of Science on the Science Channel. He's got a new book out called Humble Pie, When Math Goes Wrong in the Real World. We'll be back in 2 minutes, 120 seconds. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with math expert Matt Parker. He writes about math for The Guardian and hosts Outrageous Acts of Science for the Science Channel. His new book is called Humble Pie, that's P-I, When Math Goes Wrong in the Real World. All right, of course, Matt, this is a leap year. Every 4 years we get this extra day tacked on at the end of February. Maybe some kids born on leap day this year will still be alive in 2100, which is a year when leap year doesn't come. Explain that.
Oh, I know. I would love to be able to live long enough to see a skipped leap year. So leap years were put in because the had the length of a day, which is determined by how long it takes the Earth to rotate on its axis, doesn't neatly match up with the length of a year, which is how long it takes the Earth to orbit around the Sun. I mean, both these time periods just came out of the amount of spin when the solar system was forming, and so there's no reason why they should match up. And so a year is just over 365 days long. It's roughly 365 and a quarter days long, which is why traditionally leap years were put in once every 4 years. Because if you have one whole extra day every fourth year, on average you've got an extra quarter of a day once a year. And because normally people get a bit upset if you want to put in a quarter of a day and then no, it's not dark at night anymore, people get very upset. So you got to do it a whole day at a time. Fine. However, that is ever so slightly putting in too many days, because it turns out it's not exactly 365.25, which would be a quarter. It's 365.24, 21875, and you know, so on, loads of other digits from there. And so it means if we put in one extra day every 4 years, the year is slightly too long. And even people might think, well, who cares? I don't care if the year's slightly too long. What it means is our new year will gradually drift away from the same point in the Earth's orbit. And the orbit determines the seasons. So summer happens in the northern hemisphere when the Earth is at a very specific point in its orbit. And if new year and therefore the calendar start to drift away, it means the months will start to move around. And you leave it long enough, we'll be having, in America, you would have summer over Christmas, because the calendar has been drifting ever so gradually. And so this was fixed. And the solution was to take out one leap year every 100 years, except we put one back in every 400 years. And so that means we take out an average of three leap years every 400 years. And don't panic if you've not followed that. The end result is our calendar is 365.2425 days long, which is incredibly close to the correct value.
So the year, for interrupting, the year 2000 was one of those rare century mark years that we skipped leap year, or that we did not skip leap year, excuse me.
Exactly. And so I feel a little bit cheated because, I mean, more often than not, you will get to live through a turnover of a century. So depending on when you're born, obviously not everyone gets to see the turnover of a century, but it's a very exciting time. And three out of four century turnovers, we skip the leap year. So every leap year is, if you can divide the year by four, it's a leap year. And so this year, 2020, is divisible by four. It's four times 505. And so it's a leap year. But if it's also a multiple of 100, then it's not a leap year, unless it's a multiple of 400. And then it is again. And so the year 1700, that was a skipped leap year, no leap year. 1800, 1900, all skipped. 2000, we skipped the skipping, and so it was still a leap year. And then when we carry on, once we get to 2100, that'll be a skipped one. And so I feel a little cheated. I mean, it was nice. I got to live through a millennium tick over. That's pretty exciting. But I was cheated, and I didn't get to see the skipped leap year. But anyone who makes it to 2100, you'll get to experience that.
So people use spreadsheets to manage all kinds of data that, you know, does not necessarily consist only of numbers. In fact, we put our internal calendar for this show into a spreadsheet. It turns out this is a pretty risky proposition. Talk about how spreadsheets can fail us when not used as intended.
Yeah, and Chris, I'm not going to blame you for using a spreadsheet for your calendar. I think that's great. I use a spreadsheet for lots of things that they shouldn't be used for. It's a matter of public record. Big fan of spreadsheets. But it needs to come with a user warning. Because if you're using a spreadsheet for anything like if you're not just doing arithmetic, things can go horribly wrong. And one of the most common problems you'll come across is a spreadsheet tries to be clever and guess what you're putting in. So for the case of Excel, it does a couple otherwise quite useful things. If you put in a number that's too long, it will convert it into a shorter format. And so there's a thing called scientific notation. And that's when you don't bother writing down all the digits. You just write down a few at the beginning and then a note for how long the number should be. And so for the case of Excel, if you try this, if you have Excel and you type in a long number, when you hit enter, you'll see it's become a shorter number and then a capital E and then a measure of how big the number was. And it's now completely removed the original number you put in some cases. And so if in your calendar, if you had something and in one of the cells you put someone's phone number, some phone numbers are long enough that this will trip Excel's detect if it's a long number feature, and it will remove the phone number and put it back in scientific notation. The other terrifying thing it does is it tries to guess if you're writing in a date, which for a calendar, very useful. And people will know this. If you start typing in a date, Excel will go, oh, you're typing in a date, and it will turn it into a standardized date format, which for most of the time, very, very useful. However, people noticed that some other bits of data looks like it's a date, but it's not. So, for example, if you're doing genetic research on the human genome, we've got various genes that cause our cells to produce different proteins. And one of those genes is called March 5. And you think, oh, well, that sounds like March 5, the date. But no, that's just the name of the gene. There's another one called SEP15, and that's the name of a protein, except it looks like September 15. And if you type the names of these genes and proteins into Excel, it will totally remove what you typed and replace it with an auto-corrected date. And so people thought, well, hang on, I wonder if that's actually happening. So some researchers in Melbourne, they went through and they took a decade of genome research. So genetic research that they could find online, they found over 3,000 bits of research. They then went through and found all the data files that are associated with the research, because when you publish your research, you put the data out as well, so other people can scrutinize it. And when they went through, they auto-scanned all of this research, all of this data, to look for the telltale sign of Excel converting the name of a gene into a date. And they were able to work out what percentage of genetic research at some point had been put into Excel and Excel had broken the data. And it turns out, I mean, if people are probably imagining in their mind how often they think this happens, it was 19.6% of all genome research. So that's about 1 in 5. Now, obviously, it doesn't totally invalidate the research, and we don't know at what point in the research this mistake was put in by Excel, but I find it both amazing and terrifying that 19.6% of this type of research had an autocorrect error put in by Excel.
What happens when you ask a calculator to divide something by zero?
Well, that depends heavily on the calculator. Now, I probably most people listening in won't be familiar with this, but I'm semi-famous for doing calculator unboxing videos on YouTube. That's where I get a calculator and I unbox it and I put it through its paces and do a variety of tests. It's not normal viewing. I appreciate that. But one of the tests I do is a divide by zero test to see what the calculator would do, basically, because in mathematics, you can't divide by zero. And it's because Well, the question you're asking is how many times does zero go into this number? And if you were doing another one, like if you were doing something like a second ago, I just said, I worked out what 2020 divided by 4 is, and I got 505. And the way a computer would do that, or a calculator, is if you did 2020 divided by 4, it would just start subtracting 4 off 2020 to see how many times it has to do that until it hits 0. And it would count them and go, oh, I had to do that 505 times. However, you subtracting 0, it never changes. It, like, infinitely many zeros, I guess, sort of, can go into a number. And so it can't be done. And so some calculators have just been hard-coded. There'll be somewhere in their programming will be a line saying, don't fall for it. Like, if you're told to divide by 0, just say no. That's the good advice for calculators. Just say no to dividing by 0. And there are some videos online of mechanical calculators. So mechanical calculators, these are, you know, from the early 20th century. They're doing mechanical operations, almost on cogs, sort of, to do these calculations. And some of them, if they're electromechanical, and you tell them to divide by 0, they would just start spinning forever. And because they're trying to subtract 0. I own a calculator which doesn't do this properly. It's an old Casio calculator. And it's one where if you hit divide by 0, it looks like it's not doing anything. But if you hold down the kind of what are you up to button, you can see it's frantically divide, like this number's racing up as it's subtracting 0. And other people are probably now thinking, oh, that's all very interesting, but surely that's only relevant for like calculator enthusiasts. When is that going to be a real problem? Well, my favorite example was the U.S. Navy had this problem. So they had the USS Yorktown, which is like a massive military ship. It had a divide by zero error. So this was in 1997. It wasn't that far from the US coast, so it wasn't a major issue. It had recently been updated in something called the Smart Ship Project, which was putting Windows machines, so computers running the Windows software, onto US Navy warships to help automate part of their running and reduce the crew on board. The goal was to reduce the crew by about 10%. However, on the Yorktown, somewhere in a database, it turns out someone put a zero. Later on, the ship's systems tried to divide by that value. So they were dividing by a zero, and it caused the systems to crash. And so a whole warship was left dead in the water because of a divide by a zero example. And I just, whenever people say, well, what does it matter if you can or can't divide by a zero? I go, well, if some systems, including a whole warship, if they do it by accident, everything crashes.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, how did a geometry mistake turn a freshwater lake into a saltwater lake?
This was Lake Louisiana, which I... No, it was in Louisiana. It was a lake which... So this was in the early 80s, and there were already salt mines underneath the lake. So they'd been mining salt for pretty much a century before that. And the kind of geology which causes you to get good salt deposits that you can mine will also trap oil. And so the plan was to do some exploratory drilling. This was the Texaco Oil Company, thought they'd just do a little bit of careful drilling to see if there's any oil worth getting. And obviously they had to be very careful because underneath the lake, because were mines where the salt companies had mined next to the lake, but then they'd gone sideways following the salt. And so they now had mines underneath the lake. And so when they were drilling, they had to very, very carefully calculate exactly where they were going to drill to try and avoid going into the salt mines. However, someone made a mistake with one of the triangles, and I think people can see where this is going. So they were doing a thing called triangulation. That's where you're kind of surveying and you're measuring angles and distances to work out exactly where you are and where you want to be. And so they thought they calculated precisely where they were drilling. They were off by 180 meters. So several hundred feet in the wrong place. And it was one triangle miscalculation. And when they were drilling down, they accidentally went straight into the salt mines. And the first thing they realized on the drilling platform was when the whole thing kind of lent off to the side. And when it lent off, the platform lent to the side, people on the platform realized something was up. And so they evacuated. They just abandoned the thing and they got off, right? And then the water started going down through the drill hole. And the drill hole was maybe a couple feet across. It was like, you know, 1 to 2 foot wide drill hole. It wasn't a massive drill hole. But water started going down the drill hole because now it had tapped into the mines. Obviously, the miners had the fright of their life when water suddenly started gushing into their mine. But thankfully, they had the emergency evacuation plan all set. They all got out. No one was harmed, right? So everyone evacuated. The only issue now is the water in the lake was going down this hole into the mine. But you think, well, hang on. I mean, how long is that going to go on for? Well, there were two problems. One was, as the water was going down, it was dissolving the salt and washing away the dirt, which was making the hole bigger. So as more water went down, the hole went bigger, which let more water go down, which made the hole bigger. So it was the hole was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And the volume in the mines, the empty space, was bigger than the amount of water in the lake. So the entire contents of the lake emptied down into the mines, and the lake was connected by a canal into kind of the Gulf of Mexico, and the canal reversed direction, so the ocean was refilling the lake. And then that water was going down, and this carried on. Eventually, it was like a 400-foot wide whirlpool of water going down. And by the time it stopped, it had eroded huge quantities of land, like totally changed the shoreline of the lake. It had 11 barges that were in the canal had been dragged into the lake and gone underwater down in the whirlpool. And by the time it all stopped, what was originally a freshwater lake, and it was only like tens of feet deep, was now a saltwater lake hundreds of feet deep. So this was a total change to the local ecology because of one mistake in one triangle. So whenever a student in a class somewhere says, why do we need to learn about triangles? And you go, well, one day someone didn't get their triangle right and they destroyed a lake.
Matt Parker is with us. We're talking about his new book, Humble Pie, When Math Goes Wrong in the Real World. We'll be back in 2 minutes. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is YouTuber, stand-up comedian, and host of the Science Channel's Outrageous Acts of Science, Matt Parker. He also writes about math for The Guardian and has a book out called Humble Pie, When Math Goes Wrong in the Real World. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. Matt, you had a way of finding out whether or not your students were inclined to cheat by giving them a particular homework assignment. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So I spent a good 4 years as a high school math teacher. So I'm originally from Australia and I taught out there for a year. And then I moved to the UK and I taught in London for a couple of years. And I used to enjoy setting a piece of homework where the students had to flip a coin 100 times and then write down their results. And so I would normally set this right before we were going to start a section on randomness or probability, and it would normally be students around the age of 14. And the great thing about a 14-year-old is they are inherently reluctant to do more work than necessary. And so if they can avoid some math homework, they will. And the thing about flipping a coin is it's boring. And so if you're flipping a coin over and over again and then writing down the results, I mean, a teenager is going to get sick of that very quickly. So what they would do is just think, well, hang on, why am I flipping this coin over and over when I could just make up the results? And so what they would tend to do is just start writing down random heads and tails as if they had flipped a coin. I would then get them when they came in to hand in all their homework. And then pretty quickly, I would be able to separate them out into the students who did the homework properly compared to the students who just cheated. And the reason is humans are very bad at being random. We're not good at doing something genuinely randomly. Our brains love patterns. And that's partly why we do math, right? Because people who are into math, it's because our brains just love finding and like discovering and exploiting patterns. And so when we're trying to be random, we can't help but fall into certain patterns. And the big giveaway is if a teenager is trying to fake data, they will not want to have too many that are the same in a row. And so they will flip between heads and tails all the time. But if you've actually got genuinely random data, you'll frequently get like four or five, maybe six, all heads or all tails in a row, which looks weird to our eyes. We're like, oh, that can't be random. But no, I mean, if something's truly random, you're doing it 100 times, you'll occasionally get runs that are all the same. And so all I would be doing is scanning through, and the ones that are constantly flipping from heads to tails, that's a student faking their homework. If there's long runs in a row, I go, that they've probably done it genuinely. They wouldn't have picked that if they were trying to be random.
So here's the question. Did you fail the students who it appeared were sort of trying to look random? Because it is statistically possible, right, for there to be something that just goes heads, tails for an entire 100 flips.
No, I would make a semi-public example of them. but I wouldn't. There were no marks or grades on the line. I just wanted a memorable teaching experience. However, if these students went on into their future lives and did not take heed of my, you know, timely warning in their development years, and they would later try to fake data. So, for example, the IRS, it will analyze data which should show random properties on people's statements and businesses when they're handing in their tax. They will be looking for randomness. And if they see non-random, like if they're seeing the patterns of humans making up random data, they go, aha, here's a company or here's a person who's faking their data. They're like trying to put in, like if it's a, let's say a restaurant or somewhere who's trying to put in fake, or someone's putting in fake expenses, let's say, and they're making up a bunch of what they think are random values that they've spent on things, they will fall into the same patterns, and people who are called forensic accountants will be able to analyze it and detect that this is not real random data from loads of different purchases. This is someone faking the data. So in some small way, now that I think about it, I was training these teenagers to correctly generate fraudulent data, but maybe that's not the way to look at it. Anyway, the point is you got to know how to be random.
Of course, you can make mistakes even when you're trying to get it right. The U.S. Air Force was looking to apply data to designing cockpits and uniforms that would work for everybody, and instead they ended up with designs that fit literally no one.
Yeah, this was just after the Second World War, when in the Second World War, I mean, we were still developing aircraft, particularly in the First World War, actually, where they were quite roomy. There was loads of space in the cockpit to move around. The uniforms were quite baggy. But then, as modern fighter jets were coming on the scene, tolerances were getting a lot smaller. There were a lot more forces being put on these pilots. And so the Air Force realized they needed to know exactly how big their personnel were, so they could design cockpits and they could design uniforms that would fit very, very snugly. And so they set about measuring thousands of people who were in the Air Force in the early 1950s. And their goal was, you know what, we'll just measure thousands of people, over 3,000. We'll find the average values, and if we make things that match that, they'll be perfect. However, what one person who was on the project, a guy called Gilbert Daniels, realized was that no one is average. And this is kind of counterintuitive, because you think if you made, let's say, a uniform to, and let's say there's 10 measurements in a uniform. So things like how long arms are, how far around the chest measurement. Like if you just took 10 standard kind of tailoring measurements and you go, you know what, we will make a uniform that fits anyone who's like in the middle 30%, like the middle third. Daniels was able to show that if you did that, there would be zero people who would fit. He showed that there was no one in the entire population who was average on just 10 measurements for an outfit. And basically, human, and this is a very homogenous population. This was just males in a certain age range who were in a certain profession that required you to be a certain size anyway. And this was all, it should be very samey data, to use the technical phrase. But yet, no one member of that population was average. And this was kind of the big realization that you can't just take an average from data and assume that tells you the whole story, because no one's average. And so what actually came out of this was, to their credit, when the Air Force realized that there was no such thing as an average human, they went back to their suppliers and went, look, we've changed our mind. You can't just make garments or cockpits which fit the average. They have to fit a range. They've got to range across the middle 90%. Like, you can't just pick the middle average. It's got to be the whole spectrum. And that's when things like adjustable seats, we take it for granted now. You get into a car and you slide the seat to where you need it. That came out of this realization no one's average. Adjustable straps on the helmets. And so thankfully, when they learnt there's no such thing as an average human, they then used engineering and the technology to design things to accommodate the widest range of people possible.
Okay, people working in humanities professions might assume that they could escape your scrutiny, but you are constantly on the lookout for designs that don't work, that are just graphic designs. So one thing that happens a lot is people will make three interlocking cogs in kind of a triangular formation. For people who can't initially and immediately sort of picture why that doesn't work, can you tell us why it doesn't work?
Yeah, this is a kind of a classic of graphic design where someone will be sitting there thinking, oh, I've got to do a design that conveys teamwork or parts moving in unison or everything working together like clockwork. And they go, ah, clockwork, I know. I'll draw a bunch of cogs. But then they don't stop to think, would that clock work? And the simplest one, like two cogs, fine, not a problem. So if you imagine one cog, which is like a circular disc and it's got all the teeth sticking out of it, and then you've got another cog next to it, and we say they mesh, which means the teeth are interlocked. So if one of them rotates, the other one rotates. And that's the basis of, you know, a lot of mechanics, gears, cogs, these things. However, importantly, if one cog's going clockwise, the other one goes in the opposite direction. It goes anti or like counterclockwise, the other way around. The issue is, if you have three cogs all meshing together, nothing can rotate. Because if one's going clockwise, the other two that mesh with it should both be going anti-counterclockwise. But if they're meshed, they can't budge. So in fact, if you've ever got an odd number of cogs all meshed together, they cannot move. They will be locked in place. And I'm well aware this is not the most important bit of math going on. Like, and a lot of people say, so what? Like, it's artistic. It's just meant to convey that things move together. And I totally get that. And in the UK, if anyone's ever comes across a £2 coin, if you're traveling here, or if someone goes to the UK, get one to bring one back for you. On the back of a £2 coin in the UK is a big ring of about 22 cogs, and they cannot move. So the design for the £2 coin chose a mechanism which would be locked in place. I actually contacted the designer. I found them. And I was like, look, I don't want to be a jerk about this. I don't mind. I'm just curious. How did this come about? And so it turns out they originally, first of all, they told me that they didn't think it was important whether or not the mechanism would work, because they have artistic license. Totally get that. I'm okay. They then went on to say they originally designed it so it would work, because they were worried if they didn't, they'd get loads of emails from pedants, like people like me. But then when the design was turned into a coin, the mint took out some cogs and broke it. And so they took out an odd number of cogs, which means the mechanism wouldn't work. But now that I go out there and I talk about these things, I talk about graphic design, where the designer has accidentally drawn something not mechanically possible, And it's not just cogs, it's people drawing stars shining through the moon or drawing inaccurate sports, like sport balls. Like when you've got a ball made out of panels, people would just sketch, oh, that's a soccer ball, and just sketch a button. Like, no, very specific geometry is required to make a basketball or a soccer ball, these kind of balls. Now people send them in to me. I'm now the patron saint of inaccurate graphic design. I think it's a hobby. I think it's fun. And I think we shouldn't get too upset. But as always, it is a teachable moment.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Ultimately, the thing you're trying to communicate to us in this book is that a big part of the challenge of learning math is accepting the fact that we may not be sort of naturally gifted at it, but that anybody can learn it as long as we try. What do you feel like makes math satisfying to properly learn?
Oh, that's so true. And a lot of people remember the non-satisfying parts of mathematics. They remember struggling at it. They remember not getting the right answer. And my message over and over is that's the case for everyone. Like, we're all born bad at math, and then it's hard work to learn it. The satisfying part, I would say, if we were to define what math is, and there's no like agreed definition of math, I would say it's finding and exploiting patterns. And that's the satisfying part of math. It's when you're investigating a problem or some situation and suddenly you crack it and you spot the underlying pattern or the logic. Or later on, you've got a problem. You've got to problem solve some situation and you realize, oh, wait, this previous thing I learned about and I understood, I can now apply it to this new situation. And finding and using patterns, I find, is the absolute joy of mathematics. And it's a real shame that people just remember the learning, the tedious doing, the learning the skills, but then never using them to have some fun with patterns.
Before I let you go, now that pretty much everybody on the planet has a cell phone, are we in any danger of running out of combinations of numbers without adding many more digits?
That's a great one. And it's weird that phone numbers, we reuse them. So I think phone numbers are not long enough to be disposable. And so we would run out if we didn't reuse them. And I have a fantastic story from the world of mixed martial arts, where they would contact fighters before a game, on their mobiles. They would text them to ask what song they wanted, and one poor fighter, their number had been handed out to someone else, and that person was just picking random songs for them. And then one day they tried to request Nickelback, and that's when they realized they were texting the wrong person.
Matt Parker writes about math for The Guardian. He's a stand-up comedian and YouTuber, and he has a book out called Humble Pie, When Math Goes Wrong in the Real World. Matt, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you for spending this hour with us.
Oh, Chris, it's been my absolute pleasure.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast and learn about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.